The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yes, the Legal Lowdown, Mary McGillicuddy, solicitor, is with me to talk more issues that you've brought to our attention over the last while. Miriam, good morning to you and thanks for joining us again.
Good morning, Jerry, and good morning, listeners, and thanks for all the great queries. We've some very interesting ones in.
We certainly do, and we're going to jump straight into them, Miriam. We have had a good few queries recently relating to problems with second-hand cars. That's problems with engines, the electrics of the car. These issues usually arise when the seller is a dealer, but often by the time the issue arises, the warranty has run out. So there's a difference between buying from a dealer or a seller. Is that how it works?
That's right. I mean, if you buy a car privately, it's totally caveat emptor. And if there's something wrong with it, you're really stuck with the car. That's why it's a good idea, no matter whether you buy from a dealer or privately, that you actually get somebody to inspect the car and make sure it's mechanically sound. Some of the big problems that arise on buying secondhand cars would be that they've been clocked, you know, that the mileage on them has been underestimated, or else that they've been crashed and somebody hasn't told you about it. But it's a good idea. You can ask a lot of questions when you're buying the car and note down the answers, or have a witness there when you're talking to the dealer as to what the answers to the questions were, like, is the mileage correct? Has the car been crashed? And all that kind of thing. And that can help if you've a problem with the car down the line. I suppose the big problem in getting a remedy in relation to cars, and the thing that puts people off in relation to litigation, is that it's outside usually the small claims court, you know, the €2,000, and what has to go into the upper court, the district court, limits is only
£15,000. Which adds to the cost and makes it prohibitive.
Yeah, that's the problem. And then, I mean, most cars would be well above the £15,000, and the second-hand cars, and then you have to go on the circuit court with huge expense. I mean, we could do with some kind of an arbitration scenario in relation to second-hand cars, but and that's something I must actually follow up on. But aside from that, then, the dealer does have to provide you with something that's of merchantable quality, fit for the purpose, as described. But the problem is, with a new car, obviously it must be perfect. But with the second-hand car, that's a movable feast. Like, if it's 10 years old, how much driving should you expect from it, and all that kind of thing. And then it's a matter of conflict of evidence going into court. The other problem was, one would have to have an expert witness, like a car assessor or an engineer, going into court to explain to the judge what's actually
wrong.
And
how much is that going to cost?
Yeah, that's the... and like, sometimes people just try and do a deal with the dealer or the seller and try and get something back so that they can move on and get another car. It is quite difficult. Now, when they're within warranty, the dealership should actually deal with it, because legally they're meant to maybe supply parts and labour, depending on the warranty. That's a help. Going back and maybe with an assessor's report or an engineer's report, simply doing that and giving the evidence to the dealer would be helpful, because they then could fix it. But it's one of the areas that I just highlight that people really need to be wary before they buy the car. And as I say,
bring somebody with you as well, Miriam.
Exactly,
like, if you
as
are,
evidence.
And so you have a witness to what was said.
What was said, and like, if things were verified, that you've somebody there who could see that if they verified it wasn't crashed, that the mileage was right, etc. Now, there is a car buyer's checklist on the CCPC website, and they have very helpful information. So anyone, before they buy a second-hand car, should go to that website and look at the car buying section. It's excellent in relation to warn you what to look out for. And there are checks you can do as well to make sure that the car wasn't stolen. And also to look at the registration of the car, like, has it changed hands fast? That might be a warning signal, a red flag that there's something wrong with the car.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Some other issues that have arisen as well, Miriam. A listener asks, when might a family need to appoint a decision-making representative to look after a vulnerable or elderly person in the family?
Yes, I mean, we're dealing with a lot of these applications at the moment where somebody might be vulnerable and elderly or have advanced dementia and Alzheimer's, and they have to be looked after by family members. So that's where one applies to court to become the decision-making representative for the person. And the person's will and preferences are taken into account. But key to all this is the medical report and what the medical assessment is in relation to the person as to whether they have capacity to make decisions or not. So these this is a whole new area of law for everybody, and we're all learning as we go along. But it's a great scheme, I suppose, that the government put in place to allow family members to look after their elderly or vulnerable nearest and dearest. And if there's nobody from the family, then somebody will be appointed from a panel by the decision support service. But key to it is an assessment of capacity. And that can't be done by a lawyer, it can't be done by a family member. It must be done with a detailed report from medical personnel. And as I say, the person's wishes as well are taken into account insofar as they can express them as well. So this is a whole new area where human rights are being respected and people's autonomy is being respected in the decision-making process.
Okay. Miriam, a listener asks, can one guarantee that boundaries are exact on a land registry map?
Now, this is an interesting one because you know, the maps are on very maybe high scales. Some of the maps are 1 to 2,500 or 1 to 500 is the best map we can get from the land registry. And that would be the most detailed. But even still, you've a line that says where the boundary is. And the land registry have said, like, there might be two boundaries beside each other, but that would be represented by one black line. So there's a limit to how precise those maps can be, because obviously they're not the same scale as what's on the ground. So one must be wary when dealing with land registry maps to be aware of that, that one only can get the exactitude to a certain extent. And that's very often where engineers come in, measuring property on the ground and setting out correct boundaries if there's a problem. We used to have a huge, it was much worse before, Jerry, because the old maps weren't on the big scale we have now, and you'd have a big huge black line that would cover maybe nearly a bit of an acre, and it wasn't the black line was supposed to be the boundary, but it was very wide on the ground. But we've much more exact, you know, with the new ordnance survey sheets and digitization of maps, it has helped a lot to be, you know, make it more exact. But one must be aware that you know, it can only be exact to a certain extent.
Okay. Queries that we've left over from last month, Maria. My husband is the only living relative his grandmother has. So he received the family home and whatever money in the credit union. What is the cap before he has to pay capital gains tax, as it is his grandmother?
Yeah, I think what he meant here was capital acquisitions tax, you know, inheritance
yes.
tax, because capital gains tax would apply if he was selling property and was making a
and
gain.
And he made a profit on
it. So yeah. I think what he means here is capital acquisitions tax. And his threshold with his grandmother is 40,000. So anything above that would be taxed at 33%. Now, the only thing one would investigate here is, did he live with his grandmother? Because there is the dwelling house exemption. If you lived with somebody for 3 years before their death and you held on to the house,
you don't own any other property.
Yeah, and you don't own any other property. He might have the benefit of an exemption there. And then there's one other little thing, like if granny had left it to her child in the will and he died subsequent to her and it devolved to the grandson, then the grandson could step into the shoes of the parent for tax purposes. So one would always canvass that one as well. You know, it's another little one that might result in him getting the son's threshold, which would be 400,000. But otherwise, from grandmothers to children, to grandchildren, it's a very low threshold. And this has been highlighted. It's also the same threshold for aunties to nephews and nieces. And it's very low because, I mean,
there's a campaign at the moment to try and get the government to change that on a sense of fairness for
that's
people.
That's right. Because very often, you know, grandchildren might be living with grandparents or they might be very involved in their lives, nephews and nieces, similarly with aunties and uncles. And it's very low in relation to leaving their assets to grandchildren. Yeah.
Okay. Miriam, I've willed the family home to my daughter and a large sum of money in both our names. Will she pay tax?
Yeah, again, that's very similar to what above, in the sense that once, what we were talking about for a daughter, the tax threshold is 400,000, which is quite high. But bearing in mind the mean value of dwellings, like it's in Dublin, it's 500,000, and down here it's probably 300,000.
It wouldn't cover a whole home.
She might be into the tax net. But again, remember that there is that home exemption if the daughter was living with the mother, and there may be, obviously it would be important to look at that from a tax planning point of view, because you know you could leave sums of money to grandchildren, to the daughters. If the daughter's married, you could leave up to 20,000 to the husband, or in that kind of situation. So it would be good if the person was going to be going over the tax threshold to look at it creatively and see if you could
avail of
other tax thresholds within the family unit. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Miriam, listen, that's brilliant. We're out of time, but thanks very much for talking to us in the programme this morning and answering those questions and queries for us.
Thank you, Gerry, and thank you, listeners, and have a lovely week.
Brilliant. Okay, Mary McGillicuddy there with us on the line. She'll be back with us next month for Legal Lowdown. Keep your queries coming in and we'll get to more as they come in and pass them on to her.